Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio.
Good morning, everybody. This is Jean, and I'm opening the show this morning. I just wanted to say hi. Hope you're doing great today. Anyway, Greg will be speaking in just a few minutes, but I just wanted to start us off. And today I just wanted to talk about doing the right thing and speaking up. It seems like some people have, I don't want to say they do such a great job of it, but what happens is, especially in our media today, it seems like only one side matters. But don't think that. Your voice does matter. And by speaking up, you can make a difference. If you see something that is not right according to what you think, I mean, you don't have to blast the person and make them feel like an idiot or anything like that. You can come from it from a different angle and just say, hey, wait a minute. That is not right. Or I want you to, or not even I want, but we need to start talking the truth. And then say what you mean. Give them, I don't want to say evidence, but give them your viewpoint on why you feel what you feel, because that way you are remaining in your integrity and they can take it or leave it. Some people I find more so now are a lot more closed-minded and they don't even want to listen to the other person's point of view or the other person's ideas, but you, one person can make a difference. And by doing that, showing that, leading by example, even when someone comes up to you and tells you something, it's like, how do we respond, each of us? You know, our tendency is typically is just to shut down or start defending ourselves, but listen to what they have to say, and then what you could say is, I still don't believe that, or I don't believe that because, or whatever. You could still keep your own viewpoint, but just be tolerant. And I think we're missing that so much now. But also practice what you preach. If you're claiming climate control, or you're claiming, okay, we need to be looking out for the little person, meaning someone that doesn't have more as much money as we do or is having a hard time paying our bills, but yet we're flaunting around wearing expensive clothing, going to things that just the average Joe person cannot do, that is not staying in integrity, and that is not in alignment with who you are on a higher level. And so watch what you do, watch what you say, but know you can make a difference. Okay, Greg, you want to get a word in?
No, I'm actually doing fine. You're doing a great job here. I think we might do this every Tuesday. It's kind of nice to have you open the show and just get, you know, folks able to get to know you more. And, you know, the time will come when I'm traveling to a convention or something's going to happen, or like happened a few weeks ago. We had a thunderstorm. Just kind of broke my electric circuit here, and I was off the air, and you took over and did a wonderful job. So yeah, that's the fun of Action Radio, is that we're all about possibilities, not limitations. So everybody gets a chance to grow here, do more, and do all kinds of things. You talked about closed-minded, and it's really interesting. You know, the difference, you know, I wrote down here, difference equals threat. And it seems very strange to me that we used to be able to disagree. In fact, it was funny, if you heard Monday's show, Dr. Peter Pry and I, who agree on a whole lot of things, but there's certain things we definitely don't agree on. And it's really great to be able to challenge somebody of that stature and that magnitude. You know, world-renowned EMP nuclear weapons physics, you know, nuclear arms policy expert, and still disagree with him, and it's okay. You know, and it's okay with him, and it's okay with me, and we're doing fine, and we can get vigorous in our disagreements, but it's never personal. It's just, you know, I think it's the ideal, and I wish we could do the same thing with liberal folks, but they tend to take any disagreement as a threat. It's like it's a threat to either their ideology or their person. They take it personally. If you don't agree with them, then there's something really wrong with you, and you need to change. You need to go to the gulag. You know, I was just watching a video on Alexander Solzhenitsyn before the show started, and talking about the gulags and how if you criticize the government, this is where you end up. Well, we're in that same mentality now, but people take it personally. If you criticize them, or you disagree with them, you know, you're a horrible person. You need correcting. You need some awful punishment to fix you, because there's something wrong with you for disagreeing with them. That's what our problem is. We can't disagree vigorously and as equals and have it be okay. And it's the disagreement that we challenge, not the person. That's what the problem is.
Right. It's so true. And wouldn't it be boring if we all thought the same, all acted the same, all looked the same? It's like, yeah, that wouldn't be any fun either. I think it's always, I always enjoy having a good conversation with someone that does have the total opposite viewpoint as I, or just looks at things a little bit differently, because it can really help you see, something or see someone else's point of view. That's an awesome thing. You don't have to agree with it. No, not at all. But just be able to listen and really listen and not become judgmental or, you know, just listen to respond. It's just listen. That's it. But yeah, and I don't know when it started that we've taken this not so good turn in, you know, then especially the United States and the lights here, because wow, it's like, it's even like with the jab. It's like, if you don't get that, then right away, oh, you're not, you don't like your, you know, fellow, you know, whatever, neighbor, family, whatever. It's like, you don't know the reason why a person got it or didn't get it. But the thing is, we're not even being truthful with that. So don't become judgmental on someone because you don't know why they took it or didn't do it. But let that person have their right to decide without being threatened.
Yeah, yeah. It's like I say, it becomes so personal. It's very strange how this is all working. It's like conformity, which is, you know, a characteristic, has gone to identical, which is a requirement. And it's very strange how it works. But speaking of, you know, things you're not going to hear on the news, you're not going to hear this particular public service announcement anywhere except right here.
This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio. You've all heard those ads for people who have suffered medical or health tragedies, which say you may be entitled to compensation. But if you have suffered injuries or crippling diseases or medical procedures that went horribly wrong, it's not the compensation you need, it's the knowledge you should have had before the condition you suffer from now. So that you are never in that position in the future, I strongly recommend that you do not get any COVID vaccines. Get informed. Do your own research. For 99.97% of Americans, your natural immunity will give you, at worst, only moderate symptoms of COVID. If you've already had COVID, it's virtually impossible to get it again. There are effective cures for COVID, which will get you completely over the virus. There is no cure for the COVID-19 vaccines. Once you start down the road of DNA modification, there is no going back.
And that's our truth.
Yeah, and it's sad how many people are getting heart issues because of the shot.
Oh, I just heard there's a I'm listening.
Very
I'm
sad.
On group.
Young people.
Oh, yeah, no, it's crazy. Well, see, the thing is that young people are immune to the COVID, you know, because it affects, you know, older folks, folks who are obese, folks who have, you know, diabetes, heart disease, cancer, things like that, all the comorbidities, things, you know, as I call it, the short end of life's journey. You know, and it's the younger folks, the vaccine doesn't care, because first of all, it's not a vaccine. It's a spike protein infusion. The spike proteins break off and they cause blood clots, and the clots basically destroy all your organs. And that includes heart, lungs, brain, you know, sex organs and the whole thing. It's a universal attack, and there's short term and there's long term. And we're now getting some of the intermediate areas. There was a college student that died during a football game or a basketball game like last weekend. And they had the shot. And so it's very sad what's going on. But these younger folks, you never heard of a young person dying during COVID. You know, maybe extreme examples. Yes, I mean, because always, I mean, kids get cancer. It's usually an older person's disease, but, you know, that happens. But the point is that, you know, there was this thing I just put up on Facebook this morning, Buck Sexton quote. And he says, and I got after him, I'm thinking, he says, there are over 200 million Americans who are vaccinated, and daily cases right now are 300% higher than they were a year ago when there were zero people vaccinated. Fauci and the lockdowners don't even attempt to explain this. Ask why. Of course, my note above that comment is, hey, Buck, what do you think we do here every day and have done since 2020? In other words, March 2nd of 2020. We need to talk to him. But the point is that a lot of folks have been pointing that out, that there were no variants before the vaccine, that this was dead and gone. The original virus was gone. They brought it back with the vaccines, which is the whole point, because the vaccines are a marketing tool. They always have been. They always will be. In terms of reducing immunity, so that you have to buy more vaccines, thinking that's the cure. It's like eating, you know, more and more to cure obesity. It's irrational. taking a vaccine that is not a vaccine that contains spike proteins that teaches your body how to make more spike proteins when spike proteins are the disease itself and are killing you is irrational. And yet that's what they're trying to force down people's throats. And if you question the irrational, you're looked upon as irrational yourself. So the irrational becomes irrational. It's through the looking glass. It's the other side of Alice in Wonderland. It's bizarre land, but you can't challenge these people. They don't see the irrationality because they're not looking at this logically. They're not using reason and logic like we do here. They're simply going by emotion and wrong assumptions based on fear. So the real root of this problem is fear. This is where it all comes from.
Right.
People need to stop being afraid.
Well,
Jean?
And it's interesting because I talked to someone yesterday that got COVID. She took hydroxychloroquine and the other one, I can't never say that word.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And she said a couple of days later, she was able to preach, you know, so it's like, okay, you're right. There's another example of why it's important. It's like, does it work for everybody? No, but no medication, whatever works for anybody. But
works
why
for
don't
almost everybody.
Yeah.
It works for almost everybody.
Yeah, but why don't they give it a try? But no, it's outlawed. But what Fauci wants everybody to take, that's not even FDA approved. So It's interesting how we're brainwashed into thinking a certain way, but it's like they don't even want to hear the other point of view. But if you think of just how they're treated in the hospital, that is disheartening to hear some of what's going on now. And you know it went on last year. We just weren't made aware of it. But the thing is, it's like that's why it's important for us to start speaking up because, you know what, Fauci should not have a job. And I was reading something or listening to something today about Milley and that, you know, he's going to be, instead of being fired, he's going to probably be promoted. He's probably going to get millions and millions of dollars worth of book sales. Or not sales, but to write a book, which no one should even buy the book because of all – he's just, I personally think, evil and nasty, incompetent. You know, when he basically has the blood of 13 servicemen on their hands. And not only that, look at all these other people that are over there now that have been killed, or not even now, but before they, as they were getting out of there, killed because of their incompetency. And to be so dishonest, well, I think the only way they can get into this administration is to be dishonest. But to be dishonest, and, you know, that is what they often say government is. But that is not right. That is not right. Why are the normal American citizens put on a different level of what is right, not even right, but what is lawful and what is not? I mean, the people from January 6th are still in prison. Does that make sense? You're supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. There's no reason why they couldn't even be put out on bail and not $100,000 or $1 million. I mean, these guys, I mean, it's horrible what's being done, and nobody is doing anything about it.
Well, not completely, but you're right to a large extent. But when you have an outlaw administration, when you have an administration that never went through the proper January 6th challenge, the states never were questioned. The state electoral count was never completely done. So there's no way to have an inauguration legally because you never finished the January 6th count and challenge. And so, and plus the current regime is under an investigation anyway. The audit's coming out Friday, okay? So, or the 4th, when's the 24th? Friday. So Friday, the Arizona audit is going to be out. The rumor has it, a pretty strong one, that it's going to show massive vote fraud, that they're going to decertify the Biden fraudulent electors, replace them with Trump electors, and then Georgia's next, and then Pennsylvania after that. And we're going to have audits in those states, possibly Wisconsin, Michigan, and some other states as well. Point being,
I was told they can't appoint them to Trump delegates. But
who told you
okay.
that?
Just to take a,
who told you that?
Oh, God. I was told that a while ago that they legally can't do that.
How do they know?
Yeah.
This situation's never happened before. Don't believe anything that can't be done. What?
No, but the thing is, even if they can't or they don't, doesn't matter. Take them away for Biden. That's the first cookie crumble to fall. Because then, yes, the other states, Georgia does need to do it. Michigan needs to do it. Pennsylvania needs to do it. But are they going to? No, because they have sheep. And I'm trying to think of, you know, parodies where it's like these people in there, they don't want Trump to get back into office. They don't want America to be how it was. I mean, if you look at what it was before COVID, it was insane. I never heard anybody complain about, you know, how not being able to find a job or not being able to pay their bills. And now look at it. It's horrible. And that places have to close down because they don't have enough workers. They're the close, and I'm not saying close down temporary forever, because now they can't find workers, and they just don't even want to deal with it. Why? Because the administration, not even administration, government paid these people to stay at home. And if you were getting paid, I mean, not only the unemployment, but then the COVID pay, just because you're at home, that's ridiculous. What about these frontline people that were on the front lines the whole year? They got nothing, but now they're getting fired because they're not taking the vaccine.
Well, this is what happens when you have a criminal, you know, in the White House and a criminal government, and you have a bunch of geldings on the other side that refuse to do anything about it. This is what you get. I mean, lawbreakers don't care about how many times they break the law. Once you do it the first time, it's like a serial killer. It gets easier. So this is why they do it. Let's bring Shelby on, and I'm going to let you two hash this out.
Yeah, man. Come with Shelby to faraway places, wonderful beaches, exotic foods, meet new and fascinating people as Action Radio cruise and travel reporter Shelby Finette takes you to where dreams become your reality and experiences become your best memories. Yeah, man. Here we go.
And when I made that scene for Shelby, America was great because it was under Trump. And we're going to be great again once we get that imposter out of there. Just an opinion.
Good morning, Shelby.
Good morning. I love listening to you guys. And I'm so sorry. It's so frustrating, though. And you make a lot of good points.
Well, thank you. No, I think it's a challenge. I mean, but the thing is, we've never had this in our history. And so my point to Gene, particularly in the last little bit, is that people say, well, it can't be done. You know, there's no legal precedent for this. We even have Claire Lopez on Thursdays saying there's nothing in the Constitution that covers this. Well, this has never happened before. So, you know, Constitution can be amended. But the thing is, it's simple justice. If somebody steals, you have to take away what they stole, and you have to restore the other party to where they were as much as possible through restitution. Okay, those are basic principles of law. The White House was stolen in a fraudulent election. The rightful winner is Donald Trump. So the thing to do is to go through the process, you know, and when you find the election fraud, you cancel those districts that had massive fraud. You don't have to find every fraudulent ballot. You don't have to prove overwhelmingly that the fraud canceled out the vote. The mere fact that fraud exists is enough to cancel vote in a county or a district or a precinct or wherever. And once that's done, you take those votes out. And then you count the rest of the state, the valid votes, and that's where you get your conclusion. And if the valid votes show that Donald Trump won, which they are, I almost guarantee they're going to do in Arizona by a huge margin, then that means that the state certifying Biden was fraudulent itself. So you've got to follow the fraud. You've got to follow the fraud all the way through. And so you redress the fraud of Biden electors by making them Trump electors. You send that to the Electoral College, to Congress, and then Congress is, we're going to see what happens to Congress, or it's going to go to the Supreme Court. It's going to go one of those two places. Now, Democrats are going to fight it in Congress, which means it's probably going to end up in the Supreme Court. But the fact is, nobody's going to take any notice of Biden if it's proven that he has, you know, way fewer electors than Trump when both the Arizona, the Georgia, and the Pennsylvania audits are complete. And we're just going to start laughing at him. People are laughing at him now. They're going, you know, F you Biden in stadiums all over the country. And Trump won signs are dropping down. People are resisting. And people know he lost. And they don't like it because they think Biden is reversing everything that made us great. And that's the problem. But what I'm really curious about, just to get onto Shelby, is the folks that you talk to. You talk to people that probably despise Trump, people that thought America sucked under Trump, that he was a horrible, nasty person who was destroying the world and was going to get us into a war that Milley was going to prevent. And I'm just guessing here, but what are your folks telling you?
Whew,
I'm curious.
That's a lot of assumptions.
Pick an assumption. We'll go through them.
Yeah. I guess to answer your question, I think my network, which is vast and definitely revealed since social media is so prevalent, and that's my business is in social media and for small businesses. And I would say, if I was going to generalize, which is always dangerous because there's always there's the exception, but to generalize, if I'm allowed to.
No, feel free to speak freely. That's why you're here.
Yeah, well, most people that I could say in my network from the sentiment is what we call it in social media, what's the sentiment, like overwhelmingly, you know, positive, negative, scared. It would not be what you had said. It would just be that that Trump was very caustic, and when he publicly spoke, it was very embarrassing. Mm-hmm. And it would also do a lot of separation. So that's what they see. They don't really know all the policies, and everybody's just working their regular job. And although I wouldn't say that, I wouldn't disagree that we were financially prosperous under his management, I would also say that I don't think much changed for the majority of the people that I'm interacting with. Nothing really changed for them personally. And they're not the type of people, like most people, that have time or interest to follow every little thing that's going on or being done. So I think that the sentiment for Trump was more that the media definitely did a great job at really portraying him as someone who was divisive and arrogant and uniquely narcissistic. So that's how they felt about him, and that it really did feel like it was dividing a lot of the minorities. That would be the sentiment that I would say came forward. Now, that's not necessarily my sentiment, by the way. I'm just telling you what the majority of my followers, the sentiment I get from them. I'm a little bit less sensitive to any of that. I really don't. Egotistical, narcissism, all that doesn't really bother me because my father is like that. So, you know, it's something I live with.
But the, what, I got a question. What do they think of them, Biden, and how he is so, I would say he's worse than Trump. If you really listen to him as far as what he says and how condescending he is, if you don't follow what he says, you don't matter. And so what do they think, or don't they see that?
No, I would say that the sentiment for Biden, one of my girlfriends said it best at a huge party. She's like, it's more peaceful now. Everyone is more peaceful now. So that's their sentiment.
Have they seen Afghanistan lately?
You know,
have they seen this country?
I know. It's so, well, that's not here, though, is it? And so very few people understand how horrible that is in Afghanistan. There's a few clips on the news and on to the next thing. So again, and these aren't these, again, it's not on their backyard. So it's like, well, you know, it's very easy to overlook and it's very sad, but that's what people do. And they're just happy it's peaceful. And I think this is also from my personal feelings on it is that, this is the time that when you give everything away, like you mentioned, being paid to do nothing and then businesses fail. When you give everything away during that time frame, the time of giving, everything is really nice and easy because people aren't fighting over shit. They're just getting some money. They're happy. They're getting extra money. They're not.
But they're getting,
you know,
other people's money. They're
right,
living off other. You're building a dependence on theft.
That is not important to anyone receiving the money.
But it should be.
They do not care about that. They don't.
Because their money's going to get taken. You know.
Not necessarily. Not if they keep not working. I mean, I was in Canada. I watched for years these people are on the take. Like, we paid 55% in taxes, and they got free insurance. So we didn't get free insurance. We paid for theirs, but they got free insurance because they're on the take, and they figure out new ways to be on the take.
And
so, they don't care. They do not care. And so, but I would say the sentiment about Biden is that it's peaceful. And I think, relatively speaking here, I mean, there isn't as many outright riots. BLM movement has calmed down. So to
Well, that's because they got what they wanted. they won. They got a fraudulent president.
So that's
no,
but
BLM also aware that people are onto them now, you know, and they're not what they claim to be because all the money they were given did not go to help black lives. It went to help the people that organized it.
Yeah, they bought houses, they took trips.
Again, I would say that that's for the more savvy investigator. I don't think that's what most people think. I think there's some people think that, and of course the people that were extreme right always believed that, but
you're not converting
anyone.
Shelby, sometimes you drive me crazy, especially when it's like extreme right. You know, I want to get away from the particular, how can I say this, label, just because. Immediately I'm like, argh. You know, because these aren't, you know, I think the most important, let me backtrack here. I think the most important thing you said is what people see. And I want to deal with that for a second because I think you're absolutely right on. The biggest problem we have is what people see. And the second biggest problem is what they don't see. And what they don't see is all the stuff that Trump did in terms of keeping us from a nuclear war with North Korea, that Hillary was very likely, or at least a war with North Korea, Hillary was likely to engage with, because she engaged, you know, arms running through Benghazi, you know, to ISIS and a bunch of other things, killing of Gaddafi. You didn't see that. The things you don't see are the fact that NATO is paying their fair share of the budget for the defense of Europe. You don't see the billions of dollars in money that China paid up in tariffs and the millions of jobs that came to the United States. Now, the people that got those jobs see it, but not everybody sees it. So if the group, I'm just guessing, you know, South Florida, you know, those folks were at least well off enough that they wouldn't necessarily be affected. They weren't affected by the Afghanistan war because they probably didn't have people die there in their family, although I'm sure maybe, you know, some did. Same thing with Iraq. They don't know people who personally died there, so they weren't affected by that. People weren't affected by Vietnam unless they had people involved there, except that we saw it on the news every night. So what people saw was something really horrendous. But the protests for Vietnam stopped when the draft stopped. It didn't stop when the war ended. War went on for 3 years after the draft. It's the draft that stopped the protests, not the war itself. So you're very correct in what people see. And people didn't see their family, their young sons being drafted and sent off to a war for no reason. And once that became volunteers, I didn't care about them. They volunteered. You know, so what people see is really critical. But when I hear something like extreme right, you'd have to tell me what you mean by that, because extreme right is anarchy. And those of us who are conservative or libertarian are not extreme right. We're kind of like middle right. You know, if you want to go extreme left, you know, I could say Democrats who are socialists, you know, and you know, borderline and approaching Marxists. But I don't want to say, you know, it's just, but there are Democrats who are good liberals who believe in the Constitution and love this country. So you can't say that about all Democrats. So labels can get us, is in a way, divided. And I'm trying to avoid that division in itself. Does that make sense?
I feel like it's your show. You don't want me to use the phrase extreme right. That's fine. I think most.
No, you can use it. I want to define it.
Definition of it, but I would say
would
most
say?
People in your position already know that the BLM movement, that's not going for people that are Black Lives Matter. It's going to the people that are orchestrating something much bigger. That was my point.
Okay.
Is that the
well,
people
if you,
that,
if you,
that on
if
the left
you wouldn't
Democrats
define extreme right.
Do believe that it's for the Black Lives and other people on the other side do not. They are educated enough to understand that money is being filtrated into a whole different system that's there to destroy things on a higher level and has really nothing to do with helping anyone of minority. I'm not even sure if it's a minority anymore, truthfully. I feel like it's that's not even the right terminology. But the people that are in category do see that side of the BLM movement. That's all I'm convinced.
Yeah, see, and I don't want to stop you from saying extreme right. I want to make sure, I just want to be interesting to explore, you know, where that comes from, because I think that, you know, people who will say conspiracy theorists, and I got after Dr. Pry on this, you know, he's a world-renowned expert in nuclear weapons, and he said, well, you know, those of you who believe in conspiracy theories like you, I said, wait a minute, you know, Gene was there. You know, it's like, nope, sorry, you can't do that. You know, and because it dismisses the argument. I don't want to dismiss your arguments, but I want to understand the terms. But Shelby, on a personal level, do you see the difference in gas prices, in the feeling of the country, of the optimism, of the fact that pre-COVID, you know, people were pretty happy. Things were going well. You could travel, you could go places, you could do things, you could start businesses. Military was going, we were stronger. We had peace in the Middle East for the first time. We had nations, you know, making the Abraham Accords. I mean, there were amazing things happening, despite the fact that Trump was always under impeachment, always under some kind of, you know, plot to destroy his presidency. And yet, even with all that, these amazing things happen, but people don't see it. So you're absolutely right. But you personally, because you do see these things, what do you think?
Well, I feel like COVID in general, I think you kind of have to understand that the pandemic has done insane things. I don't think could be under one person's control anyway. So gas prices don't bother me. I find that to be a hilarious little outrageous focus that is so silly. I mean, if you really think about it, this is what I tell people. What do you got, a 10, 20? Let's just say you have a 20-gallon tank and gas prices go up 10%, you paid $2 extra. It went up 50 cents. Well, you paid $10 extra to fill your tank. I mean, that's not
the problem,
outrageous.
Though. The problem is
that
almost everything.
Travel.
Almost everything travels by truck. So there's where your inflation comes in. The reason food prices are going up is because of the transportation costs, not because the food is somehow different. You know, if you own a cab company, gas prices are essential. If you drive for a living, if you're a trucker, you know, independent trucker, gas prices are a huge percentage of your costs and cut into your profits that, that you use to feed your family. So gas prices are critical. Gas prices are the major, one of the major causes of inflation. Of the price rises we're experiencing now and everything else are a result, direct result of the gas prices. Jane, why don't you go ahead and then we'll get to Bianchi.
Sorry, Gene, go ahead.
No, that's just what I was going to say. For people that do travel for a living, that makes a huge difference in their what they pay. But also when you consider gas and petroleum, all those things are going to go up in the northern states that have to that may heat from that type of stuff. That's going to really wear into their budget, too. So, yeah, it makes a big difference.
Well, I see it more as a very small indicator of inflation, which is a big difference. But, you know, if you're looking at it that way, that's positive inflation, then I could see that mindset. But I don't think people are looking at it that way. I think they mostly just look at how much money it is on the little band, you know, the where it
farmers
says
look at
how
it
much
differently. Farmers that run combines and harvest our food, they look at gas prices all the time. Yeah. I want to get Bianchi in the conversation. And also, don't Shelby, before you go, I'll make sure any travel news that you have, you know, especially, we want to get to that too. I don't want to, you know, take our whole time debating. All right, I'm just going to give you guys more time. What we'll do is we'll extend it to 2 hours or find a way to get you. We're going to move to an earlier time next year. We're going to be 3 hours. And so we'll be able to get you guys on earlier so you have more time to talk. Shelby, why don't you go ahead and then I'll get to Bianchi.
Well, I was going to say, so interesting for travel this week, I would say that the new things is that they're opening travel from the UK to the US, but they have to be vaccinated to enter, not just tested. So that's a new thing. So we are requiring vaccination from, I think it's all the United Nations, but definitely UK. It has to, you have to be vaccinated to enter the US. I think also it's worth talking about the Canadian politics because that has to do with travel with a lot of our Canadian friends.
Yeah,
I had no idea they were doing a snap election yesterday, and apparently I find this a huge indicator, too, of all the things that Canada has gone through. Now, you could we now know what the virus is about, and believe me, I get the fact that people want to save lives. I'm not undermining that at all or overlooking that, but Canada has been in severe lockdown for like almost 2 years. They've been so locked down that they can't even get non-essential items and they can't decide on what's really essential. They haven't been able to go in stores. They were locked down so severely. They got $2,000 a month extra from the government per person. And
from each
it
other.
Was, yeah. From
they
each
paid
other.
Each other. Yeah.
So, which you have to wonder, like one of the thoughts that I had was, well, how much is it to take care of a COVID patient? And, you know, because you have to add that to the government thought process of, well, maybe it'll cost me $10,000 to have them hospitalized and only $2,000 a month to keep them out of the hospital. So, you know, maybe the mentality.
Or $20 for a week of hydroxychloroquine and maybe a couple of dollars worth of zinc. And so you can cure it for about $25-$30.
Well, they obviously didn't believe that. So they didn't go that way.
Obviously not. That's the problem. Yeah. But isn't that interesting, though? I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think it's irrelevant at this point, but they decided to lock everything down. So these people have been locked in, locked up. I mean, almost not as severe as Australia, where you actually have to get a register someone to visit. You can't even see anyone. You have to register in order to visit someone within a 5-kilometer radius. But they've been locked down, and you would think that some of them would be like, okay, you know, they're still allowed to travel. So enough Canadians have been out and said, hey, you know, the rest of the world is open. Like, this is weird, you know. We're not that far from the U.S. And I have a couple Canadian friends that have, you know, sat on their soapbox on social and mentioned, hey, you know, this isn't right. Like, you can get out. You can do things. Well, they just had a snap election yesterday. Justin Trudeau spent $60 million tax dollars, estimated, to have an early election. And apparently they're now contesting the fact that it was too close to call with O'Toole, which was the Conservative Party. But
did they have mail-in ballots?
I would assume so, but I really don't know.
Okay.
Anyway, throughout all this pandemic, the people still chose the reigning president.
as their president. Now, whether or not it was too close to call, whatever, he's going in, regardless of whatever, everybody can do their dance on the sidelines, but he's you know, considered still the premier. So I just like to remind people that it's like, what do the people want? You have to really think about what the people want. And the people, they want the safety and the security of being locked in more than they don't. So maybe
that's
not the
insane.
Huge majority, but yeah, and that's after 2 years of being locked down.
Yeah.
And
well,
he has a whole bunch of anti-vaxxers follow his campaign around, by the way. But he utilized that against them, said, you know, if the anti-vaxxers don't want safety. And so it was really interesting. But
wait, because these are the terms that confuse people. When you say anti-vaxxer, you know, I mean, you can be against taking any particular vaccine because you don't think it's healthy. That doesn't make you an anti-vaxxer. You know, it's the same demonizing language and separating language that I think is creating the fear in this country. You know, if you take No, I know you're using it, and you're using it absolutely in the correct sense. You know, I understand it, and like I said, I'm not trying to get rid of your terms. I'm trying to highlight them and show how these terms are dividing people and creating fear, and they're creating fear that are creating, you know, bad assumptions, and they're using those bad assumptions to make bad decisions.
I mean, this is great marketing. That's what it is. It's the way people are learning.
Well, COVID's the greatest marketing campaign ever. Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, but the sentiment is, but whatever the case, he won more seats in the liberal side. He didn't win the majority. He off like by just a few seats, but basically everything is the same. So even though they had 2 years of lockdown and they had an opportunity to change that by voting, they chose, and not everybody, of course, I know it was kind of close, but ultimately the same people are in charge. They didn't want change. So just, you know, and the other guy seems like a very, very good candidate. Like, would have been a no-brainer for me. Like, holy crap, like 2 years, totally locked down, $2,000 a month for every single person. Like, this can't be good. But, you know, that they don't think about where the money's coming from. They don't really care. And
well,
they just want to keep safe.
Do you think they voted for the money for themselves? Or do you think they really worried about their safety? Because this flu bug is basically a flu bug, right? It's a coronavirus, like colds and other stuff.
It is a flu bug. I cannot stand when you say that. It's so irritating. People are absolutely dying of strokes, of heart attacks, of things that are aftermath. It is not a flu bug.
From the vaccine, or are you talking about from COVID?
I'm talking about from COVID. Stop acting like COVID is a flu bug. It is not. It is not.
If we look at people who have died from just the shot, it's a horrible number. If you look at how many people have physical disabilities now because of the flu shot, or not the flu shot, the COVID shot, horrible number.
That's not the point,
so
Jean. That point is, this
would,
is not
if they would,
the flu.
If they would treat it the way they're supposed to versus the killing way that Fauci's recommending, we would see different numbers as well. But when they're
not doing the stuff,
and if you look at doctors who are having the number of COVID deaths compared to doctors that are following Fauci's recommendations, totally different in percentages of people living and dying. And that's the travesty.
Again, not the point.
Yes,
it's not the flu bug.
Yes, I know people that have had strokes because of it. I know all that. Oh, no,
yeah, I know people that have had strokes.
But when you look at the amount of people that have the flu and die, it's a much higher number than the amount of people that have had COVID and die. And that's where we're missing the point.
That is not the point. I don't care about the numbers. I care about the people that have been lost that would never have died from the regular flu, that have had the regular flu and survived, and they've died anyway because of COVID. So it's an absurd insult to be referring to this as the flu bug. It is not. Now, that vaccines and what they cause, that's a whole different conversation. And the risk-reward ratio of getting COVID and getting past it, that's a whole different conversation. But this is not the flu. And it makes you all sound ignorant when you say things like that. So please stop saying that, because people that have lost people that would have never and have never died from the flu, regular people died from COVID, from other issues, mostly from that blood clotting. And yes,
but you
they
don't know how they
too.
Were treated.
That's not the
and
point.
That's the problem. Were they treated how they should have been? Or were they treated how the propaganda people want you to believe they should be treated?
But you're
then
on
you
down
can't
another
even
rabbit hole.
Compare
that's
that
not
either.
What we're
because
talking
it's
about.
Abuse point. They're not being treated the way they needed to be treated. Put them in a hospital, put them on a ventilator. That's a death sentence.
It's
that's
not
a death
sentence.
Death
people who actually survive from ventilators. Yeah, it's not a good idea, but if people do survive from ventilators, they do.
Yeah, 3%.
So that's another one of those blanket terms that needs to stop being pushed out.
The most people that are put on a ventilator will die from COVID, not because of what other things they're given. Yeah.
Well, the treatment,
so
I agree.
Like we're never going to know the truth, but the thing is, people do die from the flu,
well,
so we can't say, well, they died just from COVID. Very few people died just from COVID. The more people had comorbidities, and COVID maybe have been the last straw to put them, you know, down sooner than later, but when you look at it, and I've had friends my age that were healthy that have died of COVID, but what pisses me off is they were put on a ventilator. And would they have lived if they were treated with hydroxychloroquine and some of the others? But no, they were not. You know, so it's like the whole COVID thing is a horrible, horrible thing. But I think what it is, it's more horrible how things are being swept under the rug, things are being ignored, things are being, people are being criticized because, no, you didn't do it right. But yet it's like you have to follow this way. But you know what? If I had COVID, I would want them to try anything and try a $12 medicine versus put me on a ventilator first.
I don't disagree with that. But that's
and
not
then why
the
are they giving
what I just said. You're going down four different rabbit holes. Just stop referring to it as a flu. It is not the flu. I don't need hydroxychloroquine for the flu, first of all. So stop referring it as a flu. It is not a flu. Even if it was, we have no immunity to it, so it is killing people. And it's not just killing people with comorbidities, but certainly the majority, absolutely. However, it really is screwing up a lot of people's systems, and we don't know a lot about it, and it just is not the same thing as the flu. So it's just, it's ridiculously insulting to anyone who's lost anyone to be calling it that, because we've all had the flu and lived through it.
Well, the difference is, I'm going to get in here for a second because we've got hold on a second,
everybody.
Whoa, hold on. Neutral Corners. This is a great discussion, but I've got Josie and I've got Pianki in the line. I want to get to them because we have guests at 8 o'clock. So I really appreciate the passion you have. What I think this really highlights is that we speak two different languages. You know, yes, flu is a coronavirus. You know, flu viruses are coronaviruses, colds are coronavirus, and SARS-CoV-1 and SARS-CoV-2 are all coronaviruses. They're all in the same family. That's why we refer to it. They are different, and I agree with that. But you've got, you know, I'm not going to go into stats and figures and things like that, but I think what this really highlights between Gene and Shelby and me to a large extent too is that we speak different languages. We have different terms. We have different ways of looking at this. And the language that we use and the words that we choose, Shelby's really right on this too, is that it does define the argument. It does define the differences between us. And there's certain buzzwords that infuriate, you know, each of us for very good reasons. But we're not speaking the same language. We're not talking about this in the same terms. And that's why one person, you know, Shelby's rabbit hole is Gene's, you know, logical argument. And so we need to, I need a little time to work this through because I want to get you guys on. Actually, if you can have an hour together, I think it'd be a great way to kind of hash this out a bit. I want to go to Pianki, and then it's Josie's turn. Pianki, do you have a quick comment here? Pianki?
I'm glad I've never had the flu.
I've had it. I've had flu, norovirus. I had mumps after the mumps vaccine. You know, I had coronavirus before we knew what it was.
I've been around decades. Yeah. I guess I'm different. You know, I'm going to tell you something. Those that have comorbidities, when they go out and indulge in things that could have contributed, they should be charged a surtax that can be applied to
the Michelle Obama
thing. That they're going to have to sleep.
No.
Like
no.
If you go to order a pizza.
If you start taxing people for your lifestyle.
Triple cheese,
no.
And so on and so on. And
then
the doctor
criticize-
said you should...
Yeah, that was a Michelle Obama plan to tax people, have like an obesity tax or something like that. No, you can't do that. People still have a right to do this. You know, do you save drug addicts? You know, do you send an ambulance for a drug addict knowing they're going to take drugs again once you fix them? Yes, you do, because they're human beings. You know, I mean, if you start dishing out medical treatment based on lifestyle and choices, you know, do we treat smokers with lung cancer? Yes. Was it stupid to smoke? Yes. We treat them anyway because people make mistakes.
Well,
you know?
When you go to a restaurant, there should be a section for vaxxers and a section for those who haven't had a vaccine. Let's go back to separating them like that again.
Yeah,
that'd
well, we can
cool
separate the, you know, spike protein shedders and non-shedders.
And as far as Black Lives Matter is concerned, that is nothing but a joke. Those that fail for that, what is it that the people that was wearing that badge, what do they want? That's what the question should have been asked. And when you find out and listen to what they say they want, they already got it.
Well, I think one of the biggest problems in this country is black supremacy. You know, the idea that people who get affirmative action, who get lower college admission standards, who get scholarships, who get grants and loans for businesses, who get all kinds of things, you know, and then say that there's white privilege, you know, that again, that comes into the irrational category. You can't say that. If you're getting all the privileges, accusing other people of privilege is simply projection. It's like Eric Trump's, you know, my new favorite quote, whenever the Democrats investigate a scandal, they find themselves. So it's very interesting. Let me bring Josie in the conversation here. She's got about 15 minutes for the Latina report. Let's find out what's going on, you know, in the world that doesn't speak Latin. Josie?
Hey, good morning. How are you? Yeah.
Ictus unum veritas anyway. Pruvis, you know, e pluribus unum. There we go. There's my Latin.
Veritas, yes. anyway, the situation at the border is so bad right now. People are screaming out loud, blaming Governor from Texas, Abbott, that he's a racist. And see, you were talking about races here. They have lied to the Latino group, to the Haitians, to everybody at the border, because they're all mixed together. There's Cuban, Haitians, there's a little bit of everything, about 12,000 of them. So they have lied, and the Democrats have told them, the Governor Abbott, he's a racist, that he's only going to allow blonde, blue-eyed illegals to come in. But if you're black,
name one. Name one blonde, blue-eyed illegal alien who's come across the southern border. I mean, I'm sure there's an Irish person that probably slipped through, some redhead blonde person.
You're
you know.
From Argentina.
I mean, redhead, blue-eyed, yeah. But they come into Canada.
So,
well, they fly in. You know, I mean, Boston set up for Irish illegal aliens. They have been for decades, yeah. But anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So they're screaming out loud, blaming him, and he's a racist and all that. And some of the reporters that they know the truth are telling them, but it's a lie. It's not true. He has never said that ever. The one that says, do not come to this country is Kamala Harris. You should be blaming her. And there's one child that died with their mom, so they're making a big deal about that, which a lot of them are dying as they come across. They drown, you know, and the coyotes, they drown many families, so they don't have to do a lot of work. They just drown them, and after, you know, once they get the money, that's it. But the Biden people have about 21,000 children in their possession, and the parents are desperate for their kids. They were screaming and complaining when Donald Trump only had about 500 children taken, separated for a little while until they got their parents processed, you know?
Yeah, but they were separating kids to make sure that the adults they were with were actually their parents. I mean, a lot of times, like you said before, kids were rented. They were brought across the border.
Correct.
There was sex trafficked. There was no guarantee. The whole reason for separating kids from parents, they said we're separating kids from adults, is that you want to make sure they are the parents. And the leftist media was saying all along that this is what they're separating parents from their kids. No, they're not. They're separating adults from the kids they're traveling with to make sure they are their parents. And that never got told properly. Again, to Shelby's point, it's what, you know, what people see is not what what is. Go ahead, Shelby.
It's worse than that. I mean, it's worse than that, though, when they come over, because the people are if they are their parents, they're doing it purposefully, and they can go back with their children, but they choose not to. So it's way worse. Like, it's almost worse than even what you're saying with the people that are, you know, migrating these children. It's just horrible, though. And I don't think most people understand that. I think most people have that same mentality, that it's just the government separating the kids, which is so ridiculous and sad. But that's what the media is not.
Well, you know, that's a big problem in this country, and actually the world, the ignorance of people. People should spend more time understanding their civic responsibilities in a country, and that includes understanding the founding laws of the country. You know, you talk about the Haitian. Let's take 10 or 12 busloads of Haitians into Canada. It's a nice, cool place. You get $2,000 a month, and you get to look at the moose.
What they're also doing is they're vaccinating a lot of the little kids because they're useless to the system here, but they're not vaccinating the criminals, the adults, especially the cartels coming in. I remember AOC and Nancy Pelosi screaming, crying about the AOC went to the border And then she was claiming that they were giving toilet water to the children, all that, which it was pure lies. But also, they started deporting a lot of the Haitians. They put them in planes. They have deported a lot of the Honduran people, too, arriving to the country. So they're slowly are trying to deport a lot of these people. And the Mexican people are finally realizing that they have a communist president in their hands. And I told you from the beginning a couple of years ago, almost, remember, Greg, that I was telling you this is a communist that he tried, and mm-hmm. the Democrats are the ones that put him in power. So they have a nightmare in their hands, because if the president from Mexico didn't allow all these people to enter in their country, we won't have this problem. But they're getting well paid. They're all in it with the United Nations. Catholic charities, especially, and other churches, they all are involved. This is a huge business, and the cartels are making $14 million per week. They're trafficking organs, guns, humans, and drugs. It is bad. It is out of control. This is out of control, this whole thing. So I don't know.
Yeah, somebody had to organize for 5,000 Haitians. Actually, they should have went to Dominican Republic. But like I said before, let's put some of these people up in Canada. Why don't Canada take about 5,000 Haitians, 10,000 Haitians? Why can't it always have to be the United States where we have to have that burden?
Because we invite them.
Because
we invite them. Canada doesn't invite them. It's obvious.
Yeah, we invite them. Oh, Biden says everybody can come in, and that's why they're fleeing their countries and they're coming here. Because Biden says he's not going to be happy until he sees 30 million illegals coming through those borders and now the Afghanistan. So all this is well organized by Biden, Obama. George Soros is the organizer with this whole thing, with the United Nations. This is horrible. You should see how many illegals in my little town of Pensacola here. They're flooding the hotels. Because I'm selling uniforms to a lot of the maids, and even chiropractors that I've well known, they're hiring a lot of illegals because they cannot get regular help. And there's a girl that came in the other day, barely speaks English. She's going to work with this chiropractor that I know, and he's a Christian man too, so I'm kind of disappointed that he's hiring illegals like this. And the girl was telling me in order for her to get processed with immigration, now they're requiring the vaccine for her to get vaccinated. So it's I don't know. This is insane.
Well, there's a collection of madness.
Go
ahead, Jackie.
Hey, Josie, where can I get one of those T-shirts so I can wear it with my MAGA cap? One of those, Joe, let me in, please.
I'll make it.
Hey, you should go to our Action Radio products page. We've got a couple of COVID T-shirts that are quite remarkable that our master graphic arts person put together. So yeah, take a look at Action Radio products on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And you want T-shirts? We got T-shirts. Oh. We got everything.
You got 5,000 mm-hmm. people with a T-shirt on that mm-hmm. says "Joe, let me in, please." On where did that come from? Who's paying for that?
I love it. You always come with your good advertisement.
Well, this is a fascinating situation. So they're paying Americans not to work. They're bringing illegal aliens to work. They're bringing illegal aliens to vote. They're blocking. They're sending certain people out of the country. Well, they're bringing 100,000 Afghanis in, sending Hondurans out. I mean, this is fascinating. This is a totally bizarre thing. Which you know, Shelby's left us. Unfortunately, she had to go another commitment. But the thing that's the cure for this, I think, for at the county level and at the state level, is what we're proposing here in Santa Rosa County. And Josie, you're here too, so you can call the county commissioners and advocate this. We have a bill called making Santa Rosa County an illegal alien free zone. And what it calls for is civil asset forfeiture. This is a local law enforcement procedure. No state involvement, certainly no federal involvement. We're not rounding anybody up. You know, we're not taking the kids out of school and kidnapping, and we're not doing any of that kind of stuff. All we're doing is taking property. Okay, civil asset forfeiture. If you're living in Santa Rosa County and you're an illegal alien, we're taking your house, which means the bank should pretty much seek citizenship, or they're going to lose their investment. You know, same thing if you sell a car to an illegal alien and it's in Santa Rosa County, we're going to take it. If you're employing people we're going to take your business, okay? And the money from the sales of these proceeds goes to the people of Santa Rosa County. Each year there's going to be a distribution where the money is not no one. It's not going to law enforcement. It's not going to be a big profit. It's not going to government. It's not going to make anybody rich, but it's going to be a tax reimbursement. To the people or a funds reimbursement to the people of Santa Rosa County. So in other words, if you come and live in our county and you're an illegal alien, not only are we going to take your stuff, we're going to distribute it to the people here that had previously paid for you. This is, I think, the best way to go about doing this. This is the way, I think, to that every county in this country can do that. They won't. But this is the exact opposite of a sanctuary city or a sanctuary county or a sanctuary state in the case of California. Comments? What do you guys think?
I think that's a good idea. I think the parents in these school districts should complain when you bring in a lot of the illegal kids, a lot of refugees. Somebody's got to pay for that, and they shouldn't be required to pay for it. So,
right. Well, schools can check
citizenship. Forfeit the money and let that go towards it. I'll tell you another thing that needs to be done, too. When you have remittances going out of the country to other countries, there should be a surtax on those remittances in order to pay for the things that Americans have to be burdened with.
No, that'd be a seizure. No, if you're trying to send money out of the country as an illegal alien, that money should be seized. You know, and again, put back into the treasury or pay the national debt or something like that. Yeah. Josie?
But you know, Greg, nothing is getting done. I know a lot of people in Florida says we don't want illegals here and all that, and they're coming in. They're coming in. They're here.
Oh, I know they're here.
You should see Pensacola.
Well, we're in Pensacola. Are there like neighborhoods that are illegal? Like a little, do we have a little Haiti? Do we have a little Port-au-Prince?
Well,
you know, in Pensacola?
I know where a lot of them are because they're trying to rent a bunch of trailers in the area where all the bombs hang around the area over there by Dirt Cheap in that area behind there on the side of the road there. And you know, this guy that we know, that he has political asylum already, him and his wife, but the little boy is still illegal, the one that got the shot, you know, the vaccine at the border.
Yeah.
He's having heart condition now. He just went, and the kids just started school yesterday, the three of them, three kids.
And the parents
do
they have legal status, I mean, the correct way? Are they actual political refugees that were persecuted in their country, or is this just a made-up Biden thing?
That's what he said, but they've been afraid to take the little boy to the hospital. I don't know why, because I told him, you need to take the little boy. He's having chest pain so bad he can hardly sleep at night.
Well, he got vaccinated, yeah. But this is where the schools need to start checking citizenship. We had that fight here. We had our superintendent of schools in a meeting, and it was a Republican meeting, and the superintendent What?
You know what the school asked this guy? Just a receipt from electricity or phone bill. That's all they asked. Nothing else.
Yeah,
and
no,
the
it's
only
crazy.
Thing he showed up with, the only thing he showed up with, a receipt from the trailer that he's renting for $600. That's it.
Yeah. See, under this
that's
ordinance,
the
they'd have to
asked.
Ask. You know, they'd have to ask.
I
want to
ask Josie another
question. Yeah, go ahead.
Being that
go
you
ahead.
Got so many blacks here in America that's complaining about Black Lives Matter, complaining about police brutality, and complaining about oppression and being suppressed. Can they not seek refuge in Honduras or Nicaragua by the thousands?
They don't want to. They don't want to because when the first caravan came and then the second one, Spain was offering political asylum, Peru, Chile, Ecuador, and especially Canada was offering them, but they didn't want to because they were told by our lawyers here not to accept the invitation and also by the United Nations because they were coming here because here they get everything for free. If they go to other countries, they're going to have to work their little butts off.
No,
but
what
here,
I said, I said black people.
For free.
Yeah, what I was saying is black Americans that complain about the police brutality, that complain about the oppression and white supremacy, can they not refuge into Honduras? Blacks here that's complaining about, can they not refuge into Honduras, Nicaragua, and El Salvador?
Sure. Any American complaining here, they can get the heck out of here and go to any country, and the doors are open in any country. Yes, they can go. Yeah, no problem. Mm-hmm. But they just don't
want
to go.
See, that surprised me. I thought you'd have
to
apply for... I thought you had to apply. Say you want to go to Honduras, wouldn't you have to apply for political asylum? Or you can go as a tourist and just stay there. I don't know. Well, of course,
No, Greg.
How do you do it?
See, this is what you
okay.
No, you just get on a bus and walk down there. That's all you got to do. That's what they do. They come up here, get on a bus, get Catholic Charities to sponsor you, Soros, and just go there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but the American people going that way, that their legs are sitting in the butts here, they're not going to get all the freebies in those countries at all. They're not going to go. Are you kidding me? No way. They know better. I wish they did, but they're not going to leave this country. This is the country, the best country in the world, where you can sit at home and get paid. Yeah.
We do that in Canada, too, for $2,000 a month. They're actually making more in Canada than they are here. Ship them up there. I'm surprised they tried to sneak into Canada and sign up for that kind of thing. All right, we've got our two guests in the second hour. Obviously, we need to do more with you guys. I'm nothing against Michael and Angel who are waiting. Well, Michael, I guess, dropped off. I'll have to get him back. Waiting on the line. But I think we need more time for Tuesday. I'm not going to schedule a Tuesday guest just because we need more time to talk about these issues. And I want to extend all your time. Or we're going to start earlier. We're going to figure out something.
Okay?
Yeah. Well, in that case... I think what I'll do now, because I know once we get started with Michael Volpe and Angel Law, we're going to have a really big discussion. So let me play my Santa Rosa Volunteers piece for this week.
God bless.
Thank you all.
Listening. Bye. Bye-bye.
This is a great discussion, but we're going to do what we do periodically. Bye, Josie. Like I said, I know you'll be listening. And you can call back in anytime. Bianca, you can stick around. Gene, of course. But what we do, Santa Rosa Volunteers is doing a really nice job. Go ahead. What's that?
It's Reverend Bianchi.
Oh, excuse me, Reverend Bianchi, and I'll be Pastor Greg as soon as my certificate comes up in the mail. I got too many. Pick one line, Michael. One of our strategies to get around these ridiculous vaccine mandates, mostly for our own personal amusement, is we're all becoming ordained ministers, and that way we can write our own exemptions, which should be kind of fun. All right, let me play this piece a little shorter. I'm getting better. We're down to 6 minutes. But I think you'll like this one, and I'll be right back.
This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, insights into our founding documents, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Federalist Papers, number 5. Once again, we return to the elitist national government promoting and future Supreme Court Chief Justice John Jay. It's hard to imagine any of his court opinions were of much use, given he returns to his favorite tactic of starting with a false hypothesis, using a false comparison for evidence, and making up his predetermined conclusion with absolutely no progression of evidence to prove his case. His basic premise is that since England and Scotland formed an entire and perfect union, which is something he got from a letter by Queen Anne back in 1706 when the states were mere colonies, that we could do exactly the same here with our states. He was, in fact, modeling our oppressor to use as evidence that we can have as good a union as England and Scotland. I guess John Jay had never heard of William Wallace and the various troubles between England and Scotland over the centuries. I wonder if, like General Milley, he knew his counterpart in England. The reason this is a false comparison is that England is a monarchy and therefore irrelevant to comparison to our states under the Articles of Confederation. Their people aren't even citizens, they are subjects. Scotland has been under the thumb and control of England also for centuries, as the King of England is also the King of Scotland, so again, this is hardly a voluntary or equal union, as are the states under the Articles of Confederation. From royalcentral.co.uk comes the current title of Queen Elizabeth II, which reads, Elizabeth II, by the grace of God, of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and of her other realms and territories, Queen, head of the Commonwealth, defender of the faith, with the style of Majesty. One has to wonder if John Jay was secretly a monarchist, and not just an elitist national government proponent. He never speaks of individual rights, and only of a strong national government with a strong national defense to defend against all enemies, real or imagined. Which brings us to the false evidence and made-up conclusion. He argues that the only way the states can defend themselves is to be under a strong national government. And that is why three or four confederacies that might form without a strong constitution would make America indefensible. And yet, the colonies, before the Articles of Confederation, threw off the oppression of the British monarchy John Jay is using in Federalist No. 5 for the model for our new nation. I'm sure this did not win him converts. He repeats himself again in this paper when he writes, "It was remarked in the preceding paper that weakness and divisions at home would invite dangers from abroad, and that nothing would tend more to secure us from them than union, strength, and good government within ourselves." He doesn't define or describe the three or four confederacies he tries to convince us the states will degenerate into if the Constitution is not passed. This is directly countered by the 13 individual states at the time of this paper, which were operating rather well as one confederacy. But John Jay is convinced that he can generate the fear with this bogus argument to scare people into running to a national government for safety. Does this sound familiar to anyone? Why else would he make all this stuff up? John Jay does define one of his confederacies by saying, "The North is generally the region of strength, and many local circumstances render it probable that the most northern of the proposed confederacies would, at a period not very distant, be unquestionably more formidable than any of the others." This is rather prophetic and ironic that the Confederacy of the Civil War, formed under the very Constitution John Jay was arguing would prevent such confederacies. Jay writes that each confederacy would be as distinct nations, with individual treaties with foreign nations. Of this, he said, "Hence, it might and probably would happen that the foreign nation with whom the Southern Confederacy might be at war would be the one with whom the Northern Confederacy would be the most desirous of preserving peace and friendship." He always writes of conflict that might happen, but he never acknowledges that his fears are never realized by the states while operating under the Articles of Confederation, or that the states had a mutual support and friendship pact through the Articles, such that if one state was attacked by a foreign power, the other states would immediately rush to the defense. The colonies had neither an army, a navy, nor a national government, but created a continental army and navy nonetheless, and won independence from England. This goes against the doom and gloom of Jay's imaginary scenarios of why something that is working won't work. So what exactly was John Jay talking about? Seems to me he has a predetermined conclusion in search of evidence and comparisons that don't exist. The source for the Federalist Papers is federalistpapers.org. The Anti-Federalist Papers are from selfeducatedamerican.com. The Articles of Confederation are from usconstitution.net. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it.
All right, so we have a wonderful sponsor here, Michael and Angel. So they've commissioned me to do these founding documents all the way through. It's going to take about 2 years, I think, to get through them all. So this is a long-term project. And if anybody wants to find the YouTubes of each of these episodes I'm creating, it's Action Radio Founding Moments, and you'll find that on YouTube. Let's give a round of applause for our guests. And get into a recurring topic here on Action Radio because it is so critical, and it's one of the least reported biggest crises in the country today, and that is the crisis of family law and family court. So, Michael, why don't you start, and Angel, feel free to join in anytime, and let you two kind of take over here for a bit, and let's find out what's going on with family court, the First Amendment, Miami-Dade, and I think, Michael, you had an update you wanted to do first before that, but you got the rest of the hour, so go for it. Yeah. Good morning, Michael.
Okay. It is undercovered, however. I've seen an explosion of coverage, and you included. So even though it's still undercover, It's enormous, exponentially bigger than just a few years ago, but I first started in 2013. There was almost no coverage. Now, the more the complaint is, look how much evidence of abuse we're showing, and no one still seems to care, which is also not necessarily true. But getting to the topics, getting to the topics today, we're going to get into Miami-Dade. But first, I wanted to get an update from a story that I have done a couple of times on your broadcast. You don't have it in front of me, but I was on to talk about widespread abuse and corruption in North Carolina. And then about 6 weeks after that, I came on to talk about not just Britney Spears, but just guardianship abuse. And then I offered an update in North Carolina about a woman named Kristen Rash, who's very interesting because she's a social worker from a county in North Carolina called Davie County, who reached out to me, which almost never happens. I'm almost never in a position to talk to a social worker because generally they're all their work is shrouded in secrecy because they claim everything is private. And this particular lady was stupid enough to talk to me. And so she was involved in a case that I was tracking. She was involved in a case I was tracking, Danielle Jester versus Jeff Therrington, and I found I had developed a ton of evidence that Jeff was very abusive towards not just to Dan. In fact, he was convicted of hitting an ex-girlfriend, so that's how abusive he is. But there's an incident by two social workers that he put his son, they have twins, but he put his son into a dog cage, an eyewitness, and he saw him throw his son while his son was in a car seat. There's photos of both kids that they come back from dad and they're bruised. And then the latest incident, the one that I talked to you about the last time was on June 22nd, the kids came back from dad and the boy was recorded on video saying that he got hit with a big stick by dad. And in this particular video, I sent to Forsyth County, which is another county in North Carolina, which is actually where the parents are. And for some reason, they forwarded to Ms. Rash at Davie County. And then we talked about that and a couple of other incidents. And she assured me that she would run an honest investigation. And then she proceeded, and so the conversation was July 15th. She proceeded to testify at a custody trial where she not only said there was no abuse, but she, I believe, committed perjury because in the context of saying that mom is difficult to communicate with, she said, well, Ms. Jester seemed to want to talk about the things in Forsyth County, and I'm not privy to that. That's an exact quote, but she is privy to it because she and I talked about it. She also claimed that the incident on June 22nd was actually the boy running into a vacuum cleaner and hitting himself on top of the head, not near his shoulder, which is where the actual bruises were on the video. So she misled the court on a multiple things, but then I was getting updates during the trial, and at approximately 11:43 their time, I sent an email to Ms. Rash where I said, I heard you testified today. I'm going to be getting a copy of the audio. If it's what I'm told, you won't have a career left. So I sent that 11:43 their time. By 2:15, the judge had called a mistrial and claimed that someone didn't name me, had intimidated a witness, and it was me, said there was a criminal investigation, and then at one point ordered everyone to out loudly tell him their name, address, and phone number. This is all on video, and called a mistrial, even though this was the second time this particular case had gone to trial. So it's still left outstanding. And to top it off, I continue to communicate with Ms. Rash, and she or someone else had the entire county server block my email. I got it restored, and then they blocked it again. And I've gotten it restored, but here's something crazy. I'm also tracking another case in Davidson County, and they've blocked my email, which is completely illegal.
But yeah, we need to,
by the way.
I need to hold you a bit because I think some of the details, you got the significant things here. I mean, this is a First Amendment case. And so I want to back up just a little bit and find out exactly what you said to Ms. Rash and what's her position in the trial again. I want to sort of focus
so
on
she,
just
what's her point? So this case, Therrington versus Jester, they had DSS involvement in Forsyth County for months for reasons that are not clear.
Social services?
Social service, child protective, protective services. And for some reason, on June 28th, Davie County shows up. And first, it's another guy named Richard Macon. And then she shows up, and they see each parent one time, and then for some reason they testify at the custody trial. So their entrance into the case is not clear, and it actually seems like they were just looking for a reason to get a couple of social workers to testify at the trial, because they both suggested that actually dad's a little bit of a better parent, so maybe you should even give him physical custody. And so their involvement in the case is sort of like obfuscated, but it's very important that for whatever reason, stupidly, she talked to me. So whatever she said at the custody trial, I know what she told me, and it does not match up at points to what she told me, which I believe is perjury. But even if it doesn't fit the criminal elements of perjury, it certainly ethically should. So you should at least lose your job. And I am
so is she a lawyer or a social worker?
Like,
she's a social worker? I just want
she's
to
a social worker. She's a social worker. She's a social worker, she's a caseworker.
Right. So let me back up a little bit. So the couple that's involved, mm-hmm. I'll just go to the basics mm-hmm. here. Because, and just to let folks know, the way these things usually go, you have to understand family court is not interested in solving problems. They're interested in creating them. And they create them so they can extend cases so they can make more money, okay? So given that all the officials involved are corrupt, the lawyers, the social workers, the psychologists, the guardian, ad litem, mm-hmm. all the people we've talked about. In fact, our Britney Spears show is really popular, by the way, so nice job there. But the judges, mm-hmm. these people all go to lunch together, they're all in a club together, and their sole purpose is to mm-hmm. extract money from people by creating conflict, okay? So now I want to identify the players.
Correct.
So let's get the husband and mm-hmm. wife that are divorcing. Who are they? What are their names?
They're not husband and wife. They were boyfriend, girlfriend, but it's Jeff Barrington versus Danielle.
So they're not divorcing. Right. This is child custody only then. Okay.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
So we've got, are they disputing themselves? Are they in dispute much, or is this fairly clear cut as far as they're concerned?
They're very in dispute. Danielle says Jeff is physically abusive, and Jeff said that I'm the fitter parent, so I should get physical custody.
So the father, the mother is physically abusive, and the father wants custody. Have I got that right?
No. The mother is accusing the father of being physically abusive, and the father is saying, "No, I'm the fitter parent. I should get physical custody." She's had physical custody since the beginning, and it actually started as a child support case. And I don't understand the dynamics, but Jeff was able to table that. She only pays her $50 a month. And here's how scummy Jeff and his lawyer are. They are at the same time he pays her almost nothing in child support. He then argues, well, I'm more financially stable, so I should get custody for that reason. He's only financially stable because he's not adding an extra $1,000 every month to the child support. But
Michael, at any point, I'd love to jump in because I'm going to give you the in and out of how and why the court, with precision, i.e. the precise formula as to why the court is at the greatest benefit to let the mother fall into poverty, to let mm-hmm. child support accrue. And I'm going to tell you
mm-hmm.
where the money comes from.
I want to identify the players first.
Right.
We really
so
need
they,
to identify the
they,
players.
Okay.
They are involved in this
not somewhat protracted about 2.5 years custody case that was originally supposed to end with a custody trial in April that for some reason got continued about 2.5 years. Maybe a year and a half. Not quite 2 years. Right. And then so then it got pushed back to July 30th. And again, uh-huh. for whatever reason, the judge, his name is Gordon Miller, calls a mistrial after saying a witness has been intimidated. When I say he said a witness has been intimidated, I heard the recording. I heard him say it on a recording. He also said this is a criminal investigation, which never happened. So they were already Department of Social Services, presumably because of things that Jeff was alleged to have done, got uh-huh. involved in their life from Forsyth County. And then it's, for some reason, on June 28th, Davie County gets involved. And Jeff made
short
an offhanded
person.
Comment.
Yeah, mm-hmm. short person. Who are the good guys? Who are the bad guys? Both the parents and the lawyers and the guardians. Who are the good, and the social?
It seems like
who are the good guys and bad guys?
From my evidence, there's almost no good guys. Daniel's attorneys are very good, very skilled. His name is Paul Mangert, the main guy. But it seems like there's clearly a physically abusive person. The two social workers said that the boy and girl told them that the boy was put into a dog cage. He's been convicted of hitting his ex. He threw the boy when he was in a car seat. There's photos all over of the kids coming back bruised.
So he's abusive. That's pretty well established?
Physically. It's extremely
how about her?
Well established.
How about her? Is she abusive at all?
She's struggling in part financially due to the fact that this thing is
going
on for
2.5 years. Is she abusive also? I want to get the parties identified clearly.
There's no evidence.
So we have one abusive guy. We have a non-abusive woman. We've got a couple. They've got a kid. Let's get the social worker in here because that's the person you accused. Of perjury. All right. So let's listen. Who's the social worker again?
Right.
What's their role?
Her name is Kristen Rash. So it is for approximately a year being investigated by Forsyth County, which is where the parents live. And then for some reason, on June 28, 2021, Davie County enters. Jeff said it was they were investigating him allegedly hitting his son with a big stick, which is what the son said in the video.
Okay.
He made
what
an offhand comment.
We got limited time.
What did the social worker say? That there's no physical abuse, that the kids seem to have a lot of bruises, but dad has a lot of toys. I swear to God, she said that in her
testimony.
She's
an idiot.
She said neither parent has any issues of abuse, neglect, or dependency. However, it seems like Jeff has an easier time taking care of the kids. She never quite gave a custody recommendation, but where is the clear action of perjury is when she said, I was not privy to any of the Forsyth stuff, even though I sent her three things from Forsyth. And that was her way of obfuscating the evidence of physical abuse. And that's the key. And then they went to the judge to claim I was threatening her so they could get a mistrial. And when that didn't back me off, they took my email and put it into spam. And then when it was restored, they put my email and put it into spam again. And then let's have Angel explain why.
Okay, not just yet. We're almost there. We're almost to Angel, but I want to do one little thing.
Sure.
So you accuse the social worker of doing what? Perjury? Because lying about the
anything. I played what she said, and she said Danielle was getting off track because she wanted to talk about the Forsyth stuff, and I wasn't privy to that. Even though I sent her, she got a video, which I first sent to Forsyth County. I sent her the audio of from the previous custody trial where they talked about the incident, and I sent her. And these are all things that were investigated by Forsyth County. So for her to say she's not privy to it is a lie. It's at least misleading.
Okay. And so then
the judge was brought my email at approximately 1:45 of the p.m. of the custody trial and determined that this is a mistrial, that we're not going to investigate witness tampering.
Okay. And so it sounds like you didn't help. I mean, no offense, Michael, but it sounds like you hadn't said anything.
I certainly did not. I did not mean for them to commit to. Yeah, I didn't. Well, look, I was trying to get inside her head. I didn't mean
to get
as deep inside her head.
Wait till the trial's over next time. Wait till the case is over. Okay, now I think we got that established. That's okay. But it's the first time. But the question is, can a judge declare a mistrial because you sent an email? That's what we're trying to establish. Do you have First Amendment rights?
He can do whatever he wants, but it is not a proper use of the mistrial. It's completely improper.
Okay.
Right.
I think we've laid out the case.
The judge can do whatever they want because he's the judge, but he should not do – no. No one who's a legal expert would look at that and go, the judge acted properly, especially considering the fact that they already held a custody trial in April and for some reason pushed it back. All the more reason to finish it. You were supposed to already be done in April. Now you want to postpone it again? But, yes, you are correct that obviously didn't mean for a mistrial to happen, but I'll accept the criticism, but I was trying to get stuff all the time. But they try to criminalize me. And look, that's not the first time. There's a public information officer named Jeff Fatah who was suggesting I was going to get investigated because of emails I sent in a Utah case.
You're an investigative reporter.
You don't
of course
know
you're
going to
get investigated.
Times...
That's
right,
how it goes.
No. They are suggesting that the way I do my job is somehow criminal.
Right.
I'm not the only one. There's a guy named Wayne Dolciafino, who's a very big deal reporter in the Houston area, who was arrested on the spot and fortunately had an undercover video. They claimed that he was in contempt of court because he kept asking the judge questions, even though there was no case in front of the judge at the time he was asking him questions. This isn't the only time that media, that they suggest that the way we do our job is somehow criminal.
No, I'm not criticizing you for doing your job. I'm just saying it's just interesting the way this is working out, that the judges are taking it upon themselves to violate your First Amendment rights. Because the whole point of having a press, of having an investigative report is you operate under the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
You're absolutely allowed to do what you do, as long as you don't destroy the case, influence the case, or somehow do that. So, yeah, was it the smartest thing to do that for email a person? No. But we may, all of us may, believe me, I don't do the smartest things on this show either. I mean, I make mistakes every day. Live, we learn on, we move on, you know, we do that. All right, so Angel, now it's your turn. So now we've laid out the case.
Let's talk.
Angel, take some time.
Let's talk about the power of words.
Okay.
Especially for judicial officers, government agencies. Words have meaning and words have power. I think we can all agree on that.
Mm-hmm.
Words such as may or shall greatly change the outcome of a statement, and may lends itself to judicial interpretation. Shall is mandatory. So though there's this notion of a judge can do whatever they want, that's completely incorrect. They are bound by the laws, statutes, codes, case laws. They can make decisions within the confines of the law, but once they exceed it, they've stepped out of their jurisdiction. Another very important point I want to bring up is that the North Carolina Code General Statute 14-209, Punishment for Perjury, reads as follows. If any person shall willfully and corruptly commit perjury on his oath or affirmation in any suit, controversy, matter or cause, depending in any of the courts of the state or in any deposition or affidavit taken pursuant to law or in any oath or affirmation duly administered of or concerning any matter or thing thereof, such person is lawfully required to be sworn or affirmed. Every person so offending shall be punished as a Class F felon. That's very important. And why is that? Willfully misleading the court, willfully suppressing information, willfully omitting information are all colors of perjury. Now, the social worker here took it upon herself to provide false testimony. She caused the court to err because she told them something that contradicted reality, and she did so knowingly and willfully.
Can you show that?
That's a crime.
Can you show that she did
this?
I mean, it seems pretty obvious, but
show that,
you know, this is court.
Can
we
show
it? Okay.
Of course, because
I
have the email sent her. But look, here's why it's important. I don't know the exact details of the conversation between Danielle and her, but if she brought up that Jeff's been accused of putting my son into a dog crate and the lady is suggesting, well, I'm not privy to that. Well, you are privy to that. She's also saying she was difficult to communicate with because she's talking about things that I'm not familiar with. Well, you actually are familiar with them, number one. Number two, by acting like you're not familiar with them, maybe that's what's causing the miscommunication, because that was all done in the context of suggesting, they're not quite outright saying, but suggesting that Danielle was the less fit parent.
I've got the details of the case. I want to hold up on the details. Angel, I want to get more to you on the Angel, hold on. Everybody, just hold on a second. Angel, I want to get to you on this idea of perjury, because you're laying out the case really well, and I want to make sure we get all the details of that too. That, you know, how much of that do you have to prove or show? You know, and who do you do that to? I would think opposing counsel maybe. So take some time and walk us through this perjury thing. Hold on, Michael.
Hit the pause button. Pause button right here.
Okay.
Because
no, that's fine.
We just described that the child was put into a dog cage.
Right.
During the hearing, and I've listened to audio on this case, putting the child in the dog cage becomes undisputed, where the judge goes so far as to say that it might be reasonable at some time. I mean, I'm summarizing.
Right. We don't know the context. We don't know the context.
Hold on, Michael.
So we don't know the context.
I want to give Angel's time to lay this out. Go ahead.
It's not disputed. So that becomes a fact.
Okay.
The idea that the mother is difficult to communicate with, that's subjective. That's her opinion, but on what basis? It's not an actual fact. A child being put in a dog cage that is not challenged is a fact. A person being difficult to communicate with, were they hard to reach by email, telephone, text? Did you not like their pattern of speech? It's completely subjective, and let's just call it horseshit. It's a way to frame a person to paint them in a negative light. There's no facts behind it, right? It's just something that can be said.
Hold on, Michael.
Go ahead, finish.
And another big problem that we have here is the overarching issue of judicial misconduct.
Okay.
Over and over, these judges, you know, they reign in these, you know, micro universes that they believe themselves to be emperor of, and it's because we fail to rein them in. Over and over, these judges are running unchallenged. They're effectively hand-selected by other, agencies, be it the district attorney's office, be it the sheriff's department.
The boss.
They pick somebody, by a governor, by some magical. Thank you. Yes, and they get put in place, and then they just destroy the citizens. Now, a very important point here is that persons within the courtroom have the ability and must take the following actions. Number one, upon notice of judicial misconduct, upon notice of a judicial officer failing to keep order in their courtroom, allowing perjury in, allowing even their own behavior, their personal contempt towards a litigant, such as a person who's unrepresented being treated as less than the represented party. That's judicial bias, embroilment, decorum. So even when they are impolite, rude, condescending to a litigant, they are bound by judicial canons to behave. And when they don't, citizens need to stop complaining about adjectives, and they need to get out their pen and paper. Here's the protocol. You write a complaint to the supervising judge, to the presiding judge, and to the whatever the Commission on Judicial Performance or the State Judicial Oversight Board is. And they're all by different names. You can find it on your state websites. And it is. Mm-hmm. And then once again, please, nobody, don't write complaints about describing their behavior or their rulings. Look up judicial canons, break out the judicial canons and state it, and then describe the precise actions that judge took that meet the burden of saying this was misconduct here. Those judicial officers will then be looked into. This is the only way out. Now, I'm actually working on a campaign, and it's called Recall Them All. And at first we started off with wanting to recall the presiding judges. We are now working on recalling the entire panel at a courthouse, every judge. So when we go out to do signatures, we just recall them all because they're all trash. And anyone who dares say to me, there's some good ones, shut up. If there were good ones, they would speak out. We have some greats, you know, whistleblowers, Deanne Salcedo of San Diego. She came out and said, hey, the judicial training is disbelieve mothers making abuse accusations, don't provide them domestic violence restraining orders, and especially take away custody of any mother who says that the child is reporting sexual abuse. Take their kid away. And she was trained to do this. Hey, there were cases in San Diego where she was given specific directives of how that case should turn out. We have a
Hold right there. No, this is big. This is big. All right. So you guys know your topic so well. I have to sort of make sure that everybody else understands.
Right. And
keep
as
up.
A result
hold on, Michael. All right,
as a result of that training, she gave custody to a guy named Henry Bud Carsons, who was accused by his ex-wife of molesting their daughter. Sole custody. That woman eventually took off with the child. She was arrested. She lost all rights to her daughter until Henry Bud Carsons was then later on accused and eventually convicted of having a whole bunch of child porn on his computer. Yeah. That was the case that she regrets the most. But that training led to a future convicted child molester getting sole custody of his daughter.
Yeah. I don't want to bring in more cases at this point. We're going to get lost in the details. And it's just
a beautiful example.
But my question for you, Angel, you said something, staggering just a second ago, that the judge was instructed on how the case would turn out. Can you
Beyond the shadow of a doubt.
Explain
the
that.
Judges collude, conspire, and many cases have fixed outcomes, so they openly discuss cases. They retaliate. Another form of retaliation is placing the case before a nasty judge. So limited as to – so you have something called – this is a national thing. And one thing that most people don't know is that when you first get assigned a judge, before the judge ever hears the case, you have a peremptory challenge where – now, there are resources, like, for example, called therobingroom.com. You can look up a judicial officer nationally and see what the ratings are, typically posted by attorneys, how incompetent they are. They'll give a competency rating. And, clearly, here's another point. If the state is on notice of how bad their judges are, that publicly available forum shows the state, hey, you have a bunch of terrible judges, and they're like, Yeah, the political hacks. We intended it to be that way. Thank you very much. So another issue that we see is based on like, oh, there's sexual abuse. Oh, you're going to wind up in front of creepy Biden-esque Judge Waltz.
Usually the head judge has power. In the investigation I did in St. Louis County, we actually got an email that the then presiding judge, Michael Burton, over there sent to almost 40 guardsmen ad litem, where he was talking about a specific case and basically said, don't worry, me and this other judge are on it. We'll make sure it's taken care of. So when you say they communicate and collude, we actually have that email. When I said the then presiding judge, well, because that email came out, and we did, and Megan Fox and I primarily did a lot on it, that guy retired at like 62. And I don't think that was because he was ready to do something else. I think it was because of the pressure from it.
Evidence
of this collusion. Oh, go ahead.
And now, it's such a big deal because let's look at the scumbags at the FBI, right? With these gymnasts. What we're talking about here is Michael has black and white evidence of a civil conspiracy from a governmental office. You have a governmental tort. Where the F are the law enforcement agents? Where the F is the DA? Where the F is the FBI? Because they are using our public servers. They're using our public funds to commit crimes. Get their asses in there. Go and investigate them. And you know what? Judicial officers, the Department of Justice does occasionally go after them, but let's face it, it's probably about them not carrying out their tasks or not sharing the money in their racketeering schemes. I don't know. When somebody goes rogue and isn't sharing the spoils of their plunder, it's probably how we wind up with the DOJ.
Right. They do go after them from time to time. Look up a guy named Casey Moreland who is exchanging sexual favors. There's a guy out of Texas who's taking bribes, but not nearly enough. And obviously the most famous case is the Kids for Cash, who are taking bribes on a very widespread level. But Greg, let's get into Miami-Dade, because that was actually supposed to be the topic
okay.
at hand.
Go for it.
So I in Miami-Dade, which I think is a county of its own, I found essentially a ring of judges, lawyers, and guardian ad litem who fix cases on a pretty staggering level and get paid very well. Like, I don't know if the chief member, but one of the chief members, her name is Dori Foster Morales. She's the outgoing president of the Florida Bar, and she seems to be involved in a lot of these cases. In one, she charges $700 per month. So I
per
do
hour.
A weekly
for
life.
What?
Yeah, per
hour.
Month. I'm sorry, $700 per hour. And the way
a judge?
She got it
to do what?
She, yeah, no. This is the lawyer. The lawyer charges her client $700 a month an hour. But here's the best part: she got the judge to rule that. She's representing mom. I can't remember the woman's name. That mom's husband, Gabe Shapiro, paid for her bill. At the same time, Gabe was paying not only for his own lawyer, but she got the judge to order him to pay for the guardian ad litem and I think several other people who were put on the case. So not only does she charge a lot of money, but she gets judges to get the other litigants to pay for everything.
Who says
Trump
doesn't pay?
Megan Fox.
I got it. Can I chirp in? Because I deal with scumbag attorneys throughout every minute of my life. Let's talk about the billing here because Michael is so on point. The really big deal about this pig. Am I allowed to say that? Am I just allowed to call her a pig? Is that just a really good description? That's her nickname.
I don't like personal attacks in general. It's better to describe what they do, and we can make our own judgments on them.
The piggy-like foraging behavior of Dori Foster Morales is she loves to self-aggrandize. She loves to remind everybody that she's the exiting state bar president. She loves to tell everybody that to somehow justify her hourly rate. Now, Dori Foster Morales, just as Michael said, charges $700 per hour to represent. I'm sure she probably charges some people even more. But in this case,
she's a pig. You're right.
Very piggy behavior. Miss Piggy charges an unemployed. Now, wait. Is anybody else listening to this? This mother is unemployed. Let's say that, folks. Unemployed. Do you know a lot of unemployed people that can afford $700 an hour attorneys? Does that seem like an ethical amount to charge an unemployed person?
Well,
right,
obviously not.
There was dead silence, so I'm going to say no. But that on top of it, she is falsely accusing, this mother, Patsy, is falsely accusing the father of child abuse. Completely
that happens all the time. See, now, there's a good question I want to ask you. Hold on a second, Michael. In general, because I had the same thing, my ex's attorney wanted to accuse me of child molestation. And, of course, it was bogus and it was hysterical. I told my ex, I said, look, you put your daughter on the stand and our daughter on the stand to lie for you? She's going to hate you forever. And nothing, of course, happened with that because it was a bogus charge. But how many times does this happen that one that partner accuses the other? Because usually the guys get accused because it's easier to do it. How bad is this? False accusations.
The stats vary everything from 4% to 90%. I think no one actually knows. However, in Miami-Dade, we did find a lot, and it's called the silver bullet technique, or at least that's the term I use, is the silver bullet technique. In one of the other cases, we have the woman called in a domestic abuse report, and the cops showed up, and I got the body cam footage. And in the 10-minute span, she at one point claimed she wasn't thrown to the floor. Then she claimed she was thrown to the floor. Then at one point, she said there was no bruises, and then she said there were bruises. In a 10-minute period, she made four different stories right on body cam, and yet her ex was still arrested. They still got a restraining order, which still gave her leverage in the divorce. And that's Eric Satin.
Well, that's why it's done.
Another case.
This is power and leverage.
And right. Now, in Gabe, the first case we're talking about, Gabe Shapiro with Patsy the ex, that was the falsity really ran through the social worker, whose name is Derek Lovett. So his 5-year-old came to him and said, I think mommy's boyfriend's son was doing something sexually bad, and he takes it, and it then goes to the Child Protective Services in that area, and the social worker, Derek Lovett, number one, only interviews the child with mom present, so you have the perp right hovering over, so of course they don't open up. And then immediately after that, Lovett goes to Gabe and says, I'm going to testify at the next hearing that's available, and I'm going to say you're putting these thoughts in your son's head. So basically the court and social, and this happens all the time, the social services, what they do is they turn onto the protective parent, just like we saw in North Carolina, and they try to besmirch or attack the protective parent, and that's how the abuse is obfuscated. And it's definitely
The good parent loses, the bad parent wins. Everybody gets, you know, everybody's furious, and the case continues, which is the whole point. Continue the case. Yeah, I want to get to Angel here. We've got about 14 minutes left. Angel,
well,
how is this used?
Let's just talk about, because the big deal here is
false accusations. Go ahead.
Okay, now, so the best, the CPS, DCFS, whatever alphabet soup they want to call themselves that are there to protect the children, which is just complete horse crap.
Right. You can say that, too.
Their favorite is to say alienation or coaching. And the reason that these creeps, and I say creeps because if you look across, they are almost always childless. They are freaks.
Oh.
There's no standard to become a CPS worker.
Who are you talking
worker.
About?
You can be
judges, lawyers, social workers, what?
No,
who's
the,
not
the
having...
social, the quote-unquote, well, they call themselves social workers, but they can be called a case manager or
and they don't have
investigator.
Kids?
No, they most
kids?
Of them do not have children. They have almost none of them have any formal training. I'm not kidding you. That's how they wind up with like.
No,
perverts.
I believe
Never
it. I just
forget.
Find it ironic that people in child protective services don't have kids. I mean, I just find that interesting.
Well, it's because they're creeps. Haven't you ever heard, like, if you want to find the creeps, go to where the children are? They find themselves, you know, oh, I want to be a Boy Scout leader. Okay, so
Little League coach.
The whole point, but here's the deal. So everyone needs to know about this. So their favorite accusation against a parent is psychological abuse for alienation or coaching. It is it is a phantom accusation. Unless somebody has spy cameras inside of a house and they see a parent hypnotizing the child, waterboarding, and convincing the child to say certain things, it is complete nonsense that these children are so-called brainwashed, coached. A child has a very, I think we can all, anybody who has children, but these creeps don't, know that a child before the age of 8 doesn't really even understand a secret. So they will say, you know, oh, I'm just kidding, or that's not the truth. They can't hold on to a lie. They can't figure out that you can say something that's separated from reality and that other people would believe it. They have a really hard time doing this, and a child can't repeat a very long narrative. And then furthermore, you know, at the end of the day, right, there are parents who say like, oh, you know, yeah, mommy's being crazy today, or, oh, daddy's in a bad mood. You know, is that alienation? Is that making the child, are you brainwashing a child? No, sometimes it's just a simple statement made to comfort a child when a parent is not behaving like a parent. And, but you know, in a unified household, the child isn't taken away. Social services doesn't come in. And this is all about money. Money, 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 money. And at the end of the day, look at the size of this litigation. In the case of Gabe Shapiro, each hour of litigation costs him in excess of $2,000 per hour. And it's all on the basis of being falsely accused. He's falsely accused of coaching his children. And being a drug addict. What's more disturbing is that Gabe was then forced to pay in excess of $100,000 for court experts to investigate these allegations that he is a drug addict and that he's mentally ill. And what he does, here we have to say something. Even within the hearing, guardian ad litem tells the judge. And so does Dory Foster Morales. He's got plenty of money. He's a multimillionaire. So they're discriminating against his father. In open court, they're saying, let's rob him. Let's let's really take this guy to the cleaners. There's lots of money to pay for me to fat in my face. Come on, judge, give me some more money. Pound it out of this guy. Order it. Make court orders that he has to pay us for completely frivolous litigation. And they got away with it because they had a bad judge. And that judge, thank God, because of good work, you might be the other person that helped that might be on the line. She recused herself from the case because they were getting caught. And right now, this case is looking at the point of they are going to be looking at, you know, we come up with things with employment practice lawsuits, you know, regrettably terrible women falsely accuse men of rape, destroy their businesses, their character. And so the question,
well, what do you recommend for that? Because, I mean, I've got an idea, but for women who do this, what kind of penalty are you thinking?
There are case laws. Okay, first of all, in other, and, you know, this isn't legal advice, but, you know, anybody can go look this up, Google Scholar. You can look up Justia or, you know, your case mine. And you can find cases where, like, for example, in California, Family Code 3027.1 says that, hey, guess what, psychopaths? If you falsely accuse somebody of abusing the child and then we come to the conclusion that you made it up, you get to pay all of the other party's legal fees. And this should just be, right. I mean, like, you're like, oh, wait a minute, that's like common sense.
That's going to discourage real accusations too, though. But and by one of the three cases that I worked on in Miami-Dade, it was Jennifer Tolston, and she was accused of parental alienation by a guy who not only abandoned his family for periods of time, was also physically abusive. But we were talking about the First Amendment. So Megan.
Yeah, I want to get back to that. We got about 8 minutes.
Right.
Yeah, so how does that fit in, Michael?
We were doing what we called the live stream. So we first had Gabe Shapiro on. No, I think we first had Eric Santon on, then Gabe Shapiro, then this woman, Jennifer Tolston. Each of the three has either had their First Amendment rights threatened, like Jennifer Tolston, or just flat out violated. Eric Santon wound up going to jail. Now, ostensibly, not so much for the interview, because the interview wasn't really even mentioned in the motion and order that put him in jail. However, that motion was filed like days after his interview. And then,
so
in order to get out of jail, he had to give up his First Amendment rights. He had to agree to an injunction that he would not talk to any third party outside of the court process about any part of the case. In fact, I was mentioned specifically by name as a person he could no longer talk to. Gabe can still talk about his case. He just can't mention almost anything in it, any of the psychologists, any of the court appointees. Jennifer Tolston is facing an October hearing where it's called a motion to order to show cause, and they are saying that the interview she did violated some prior order. Eric Santon looked up other cases involving his guardian ad litem, Cindy Kamen, and his ex-wife's attorney, Jordan Abramowitz, and he found a pattern that Cindy always steered the recommendations towards Jordan's clients. He was then ordered not to talk to any other litigants in Miami-Dade because he was making the connections. So what you see is the system attacking everyone and attacking your First Amendment rights, similarly to what happened in North Carolina, similar to what happens in a lot of different places.
Let's focus in on that because I want to understand this. So hold on, Michael. Hold on just a second. So I watched the video. So these people appear in videos with you and I think Megan Fox. And so because they appear in the video, is this after the family court case or is this during?
It's after.
During.
The cases are still ongoing, but the damage has largely already been done. But
okay, so if it's during the case, hold on a second. If it's during the case, aren't there some kind of rules against, you know, you can't take pictures in court, for example? That's why they have these artist renditions of the people, okay? So are there rules against interviewing people during an ongoing family law case or not? I would think
there
would be, actually. They're not.
Except for the rules that they create, what they say is by talking about this case, you are violating the privacy rights of your child, that this hurts your child. Look, in Jennifer Tolston's case, they said that she disclosed intimate details of some report that she wasn't allowed to, except they don't say what details she disclosed, and all she said was that this particular person, I think his last name was Yablon, that he did a report.
They just want to enforce powers that they don't actually have, and out of fear and intimidation, which is against judicial canons, these judges are seemingly getting away with it, but they're really not. Like, at the end of the day, you know, like the whole parental alienation, that's a zero evidence. It's a spectral evidence, just like a witch trial. And what they're doing, what they are acting in an illegal way to take away your rights. You have petitioning rights. You have the right to discuss your case. And then there is, and the great one is, I forgive me, but I think it's Massachusetts where it was called Shack v. Shack, S-H-A-K v. S-H-A-K, and that was a very recent case where the Court of Appeals, it was the same bullshit of, oh, sorry for the bullshit, but, okay. You know, dad's discussing the case, and just in case there's any minors listening, dad's discussing the case
they
on
do.
Social media and causing and calling the mom a tramp, and it's hurting the kids. And so luckily, the justices who aren't these, you know, lowly family court judges said, wait a second, these kids are like 4 and 6. They're not on friggin' social media. This is a bunch of hogwash. The kids are not being negatively impacted unless the other parent is showing them these negative comments that they don't even understand. There's no way that the children would have access to this area of the internet. So it's not true that this is harming the children in any way. We're calling BS, and we're saying father has free speech rights to speak negatively about the mother on the internet.
Here's the key. In these cases, what the people are speaking out about is the injustice, the lack of due process, the corruption, and the people who they are accusing of corruption are the ones taking away their First Amendment rights. A little of the interviews may be going after the ex, but most of these interviews are talking about how the court didn't allow evidence in. Gabe described in detail how after my son came to me, I took it to CPS, and the next thing you know, this guy, Derek Lovett, is involved, and he interviews, I think it was his son, in front of my ex-wife. And then right after the interview, he comes to me and he says, at the next court hearing, I'm going to testify that you are coaching them. He's describing the behavior of the social worker. And by the way, these social workers like Lovett, like this lady, Kristen Rash, they're a dime a dozen, all drunk on power. This is a matter of public interest, but these are...
No, I agree with you. It's definitely a public interest, but here's the problem. Here's what I see happening. We got 2 minutes left. It seems to me that the judges, you know, if it's during a trial, I think if you have information, I would give it to opposing counsel, the one that, you know, and say, hey, this is what I think is going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't see why you can't do that. To do something on the internet during a trial or during a court case, I'm a little suspect of that just because we don't want to influence the situation. But I think the real problem that you're talking about is that the judges, the corrupt judges, not only want to be corrupt, they want the fact that they want the power to cover up the fact that they're being corrupt. And that's where I think the real essence of what this is. The First Amendment is saying, I mean, after the court case is over, I think you have absolutely, that's why they have appeals, right? You don't do an appeal during the process, you do it after the process.
No, you don't? This is all really bad. That's completely incorrect.
Okay.
This is all going way off the rails.
Bring us back.
Okay, first of all, let's talk about the fact, we have to talk about the fact that appeals are not a second trial. It's not a trial de novo. Like, you get another to bring everything back in and have smarter
judges
re-decide.
You go over the things that went wrong in the first one.
It's very difficult. You do appeals while a case is going on. An appeal is not done after the case is over. That is completely incorrect.
Okay. All right. We've got about a minute left.
Talking about abuse and corruption in the case, and Yvonne Cuesta is the judge's name in Gabe Shapiro's case. She wound up recusing herself. Would that have happened without the media pressure? We'll never know. I don't believe it would have.
Okay, that's true.
You are trying to influence, but you are – look, you're not going to get a media interview if you just want to bash your ex. Who's going to want to interview you about that? You're being interviewed by investigative reporters to talk about abuses and inadequacies in the system and how they apply to your case. And that's a matter of public interest. But as far as your own case, that's the only way that you can positively influence a corrupt case. So sometimes you have no choice.
The guardian in Shapiro's case is beyond corrupt. She's beyond corrupt. Right. She paints her favorite, the abusers, her name is Anastasia Garcia. Right.
Well, think about it. These are public trials, right?
Right.
I mean, anybody can go watch these. These are public trials that can be filmed or no.
I don't know if they can be filmed, but look, in North Carolina, the court records the audio. Where did I get all of this audio? Where am I saying that I know the judge said this? Because I ordered the court audio, so it's at least recorded. Look, it's better if you have video, and some of them do video, but most of them are at least recorded. They should have transcripts. We have open courtrooms, period. There are certain times where some parts are closed, but very rarely, and they're not supposed to. We have open courtrooms, including in family courts, all right? And this whole privacy of the child rights, number one, that right isn't really in any document. Number two, you are violating people's rights, people's due process rights, and then you're hiding behind the right of the privacy right of the child. You are putting into a bad situation. It's disgusting.
Let me hold you up because we're out of time. We're actually off the clock now.
Mm-hmm.
So what I want to do is I want to pick this up again another time. Maybe even have you on individually so we can take more time just because there's somebody. You both have expertise in different areas, and I think that might be causing a little bit of confusion too. I want to go back to the idea of influencing a trial while it's going on because I think that's really important. I haven't thought it through. That's why I'm asking you the questions. Okay, I could be wrong. I probably am.
Right.
But I want to be able to hash this out with both of you. So let me let you go for now. Angel Law and Michael Volpe, thank you very much for being on the show. Gene, I was going to get a question for you, but we got carried away. Thank you, Gene, for producing today. And we'll be back tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio at blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. And 7 o'clock in the morning Central Time is when we do it again.
Have a good day.